The headline: Saudi warplanes bomb civilian targets in Yemen after the Yemeni army fires missiles at multiple Saudi targets, including Aramco facilities, on the 7th anniversary of the war. Ukraine's President Zelensky urges energy producers to increase output to help EU wean itself off Russian supplies. Plus, Iran says it reserves the right for drilling in Arash gas field in the Persian Gulf, warning that a decision by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia to produce gas at the shared field is illegal. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: deadly Saudi air raids on Yemen continue unabated. Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against the War Act country, targeting Yemen's facilities in response to Friday's missile strikes by the Yemeni army. At least 8 people, including women and children, were killed after Saudi warplanes carried out attacks targeting residential areas in the capital, Sana'a. Several others were wounded. The warplanes also raided oil and electricity facilities in the port city of Hodeida. Local sources say the raids caused massive damage to residential neighborhoods and civilian facilities. A number of areas in the province of Sada were targeted as well. The attacks happened after the Yemeni army targeted Saudi state-run oil giant Aramco facility in Jeddah and other vital sites in the capital, Riyadh, with missiles. The army said the attacks were carried out on the eve of the 7th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh. The targeting of Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries with a large number of drones. The targeting of Aramco in Jizan and Najran with a large number of drones. Targeting locations in Jizan and Dahran in the south, as well as Abha and Khams Mashit with ballistic missiles. The armed forces will continue to carry out attacks on important targets with the aim of breaking the siege.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. The army says it will continue its retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the Islamic Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
Social media users have made comments on the 7th anniversary of the Yemen war, as well as the latest retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Let's listen to some of those comments in today's edition of Hashtag Trending.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here. As Yemen marks the 7th anniversary of the Saudi-led war against the country, the Yemeni army has launched several coordinated strikes against the Arab Kingdom. So let's review some of the events on the ground, as well as the reactions on social media in this edition of Hashtag Trending. The Yemeni army says it has conducted strikes on Aramco oil facilities in the strategic port city of Jeddah, and that their drones have conducted strikes on the Ras Tanura and Rabiq refineries. Crucial facilities in the capital Riyadh, Najran, and Jizan also came under attack from Yemen. Yemenis say that the strikes were a response to the continued Saudi aggression against their country and the crippling blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. They say that such strikes will continue until the siege of Yemen is lifted. Our first comment of the day comes from H. Sumeri. The Yemeni army has announced ballistic missile and drone strikes on Riyadh, Jeddah, Jizan, and Najran in Saudi Arabia. Vital infrastructure and oil facilities targeted as part of efforts by the Yemenis to end the Saudi blockade on Yemen. Check it out. Our next tweet comes from Asaf Bai. Yemeni resistance is stepping up retaliatory strikes deep inside Saudi Arabia for their acts of continuing aggression and siege of Yemen. Tim Anderson has our next tweet. Yemeni cruise missile strikes Saudi Aramco facility in Jeddah. The dirty war on Yemen is sustained by the whole world, minus Iran and Syria, pretending that an exile in Riyadh is president and the coalition government in Sana'a is just rebels or Houthis. Social media users believe that the Yemenis have every right to defend themselves against the Saudi-led aggression and blockade on the country that turned their country, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and that's according to the UN. So here are some of those comments. Abbas said, it's the legitimate Yemeni response to 7 years of brutal aggression on Yemen. Saudis can't expect to keep bombing Yemeni cities and not receive a missile strike as retaliation. And even then, the Yemenis show their morals, even in war, where not a single casualty occurred. Ali Yemeni tweeted, in retaliation for over 7 years of Saudi aggression on the people of Yemen, the Saudis are also imposing a siege on all food, medicine, and oil. The Yemeni army has every right to retaliate and defend its people from this unjust war. The USA and UK are supporting the Saudis. And over here, we have a great example of something that the Saudis should know by now. What goes around comes around in this photo right here. A bombing in Sana'a in 2015 and a bombing in Saudi Arabia 2022. With this comment attached to it by Bil Awal, the Saudis started it first in Yemen and made it the worst famine-affected country. Yemen has been suffering for 7 years, and now it's time for retaliation. If Saudi Arabia wants to be saved, it needs to get the hell out of Yemen and stop bombarding it. Meanwhile, voices are rising against Formula One authorities who plan to hold the race in a country that is accused of committing war crimes against Yemen. They say that Riyadh has spent millions upon millions of dollars on lobbyists in the United States to whitewash the war on Yemen. And here's our final batch of comments for today. The next tweet comes from @WarPowersReform. March 26th marks the 7th anniversary of the disastrous war in Yemen, which has resulted in almost 500,000 deaths. The Saudis have spent more than $100 million on lobbyists and public relations specialists in the U.S. to whitewash the war. Thank you. Time to get back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Elsewhere, the month-long Russian military action on Ukraine has raised concerns over energy supplies all across Europe. Now Ukraine is urging energy-producing countries to increase output to help the EU wean itself off Russian supplies.
I ask you to increase the output of energy to ensure that everyone in Russia understands that that no country can use energy as a weapon and blackmail to blackmail the world.
President Volodymyr Zelensky made the call in an address to the Doha Forum International Conference. He said countries like Qatar could make a contribution to the stabilization of Europe. The Ukrainian leader said the future of Europe depends on efforts of energy-producing countries. Zelensky's comments come as energy prices have soared recently in Europe, mainly due to sanctions imposed by the West and Russia's energy sector over the Ukraine conflict. Now Europe is trying to find ways to reduce its dependence on Russian gas. On day 31 of the Russian conflict in Ukraine, Johnny Miller is in the capital, Kiev. We earlier spoke to him about the latest situation there and in other Ukrainian regions. Let's take a listen.
Well, in Kiev at the moment, everything is quite peaceful. The last strike here, missile strike, was about 3 or 4 days ago at a shopping center. There hasn't been any strikes since. The sirens in Kiev blare a few times every day. You can hear bombing in the distance. But the hope here in Kiev is that Kiev won't be attacked at all. The Russians have said that the first phase of their, as they say, special military operation, the war here, is over, and now they're going to concentrate on the east, the Donbass region. There are some reports that the Ukrainian army has taken back some towns outside Kiev. Those are unconfirmed, but it looks like at the moment, as the Russians are saying, they're focusing on the east. And the hope here in Kiev is that there won't be as many missile attacks here, and indeed the hope is they won't attack Kiev at all. I think in the war so far that they planned to win the war in a matter of days. They hoped that the Ukrainian army would capitulate. That hasn't happened, of course. The Ukrainians put up a fierce fight. It's very difficult to know what the Russian plan was, so it's difficult to know whether they've changed plan or whether this was their plan all along. But now, as I said, they are saying that they're going to focus on the east, Donbass and Luhansk. They've said that that's their major war aim, to make these places into independent republics. Right now they're fighting over Kharkiv and Mariupol. It's difficult to know whether they plan to take Kiev or whether that they've changed that plan, but at the moment the focus is very much on the east of the country. Well, there's been a lot of strikes. Difficult to know just how much of the Ukrainian military has been destroyed by Russia. The Ukrainians claim they've killed tens of thousands of Russian soldiers. The Russians themselves claim that that figure is only 1,500. So it's difficult to know in terms of casualty figures and how much military equipment either side has destroyed.
Well, a new report has revealed that Russia's allegations over the involvement of the U.S. president's son in financing biological laboratories in Ukraine are true. According to British news website Daily Mail, emails from Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop show that he helped secure millions of dollars of funding for a U.S. contractor active in Ukraine. The contractor is specializing in researching pandemic-causing pathogens that could be used as bioweapons. Moscow says Washington must explain about Hunter's role in the project. It has also accused the U.S. and Ukraine of working with pathogens of dangerous infections in 30 laboratories across the country. However, Western countries dismiss the allegations as Russia's propaganda aimed at justifying its military operation in Ukraine. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and political analyst. He says the new findings prove how the U.S. intelligence controls the American mainstream media.
It just goes to show how pathetic the corporate media cartel can be and how infiltrated it is these days by the U.S. intelligence apparatus. I can understand people raising questions about what the facts mean, but to completely ignore the facts is a whole different thing. What these emails establish is that Hunter Biden not only raised funding for a U.S. defense contractor specializing in bioweapons and bioresearch in the Ukraine, but that Hunter and his mates also invested in that operation. And moreover, there are emails which have a senior member of the defense contractor speaking to Biden about how their involvement in this project might be leveraged to assert the Ukraine's freedom or independence, if you like, from Russia, and to integrate it into Western culture and the Western economies.
Iran has rejected as illegal a decision by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia to produce gas at a Persian Gulf field shared by the three countries, saying it reserves the right for drilling in Arash gas field. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says, based on international regulations, any decision to tap Arash field has to be discussed with all parties, including Tehran. He said the agreement is illegal, and in contrast to previous negotiations, Khatibzadeh noted that the gas field is a joint field between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, while parts of it are located in areas between Iran and Kuwait whose water boundaries have not been defined. Earlier, the two Arab countries signed a deal to ramp up the output of gas reserves, ignoring Iran's right in the Persian Gulf area. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. This modern ignorance is not the same everywhere in the world. In my opinion, one clear and complete example of modern ignorance is the US. This form of ignorance is more serious and severe than anywhere else in the world. This is the case in the true sense of the word. The US is a regime which promotes indecent conduct, in which discrimination is exacerbating on a daily basis, and in which national wealth is increasingly flowing towards the wealthy and rich. A country as rich as the US is in a situation that people die on the streets if the weather becomes cold. And when it becomes hot, people also lose their lives on the street. Why? What does this mean? Today, the embodiment of modern ignorance, discrimination, oppression, and generation of crisis in the world is the US.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Basically, the United States regime is a crisis-making and crisis-feeding regime. They feed off crisis. They nourish off the various crises that occur in the world. It is such a regime. There are networks of mafia power in the US, and these networks feed off and take advantage of the crises that occur throughout the world. The US is basically a mafia regime. The United States is a mafia regime. Political, economic, and weapons manufacturing mafia. There are all sorts of mafias which control and manipulate the politics of that country. Behind the scenes of governments, they bring individuals to power and oust some from power. Such mafias install presidents. These mafia cartels and this mafia regime need crisis to exist throughout the world. Therefore, they create centers of crisis. Notice how many crises they created in West Asia. The Americans even felt the need to give birth to a creature called Daesh, or ISIS, which was their trained dog. This creature was trained to publicly film the beheading, burning, and drowning of individuals. It was the US that created this creature. They themselves acknowledged that they created that creature. They are the generators of crisis.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done for me through all my years.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week, we are focusing on the diplomatic ties between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Kenya. These two great nations have enjoyed cordial ties that have continued to improve over the years. To discuss this, we are joined by two special guests. In the studio here, we have His Excellency Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran. And joining us via video link is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Stay with us till the end of the program. And as I told you earlier, here in our studio in Tehran, we have His Excellency Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you, Barak, for this opportunity.
And joining us from Kenya via video link is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Thank you very much, Ambassador Jafar Barmaki, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for David. Invitation.
And now, before we proceed with our discussion, let's listen to a brief introduction of our subject today.
This year marks 50 years since the establishment of diplomatic ties between Iran and Kenya. These ties witnessed tremendous progress following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. These two countries enjoy historical ties that continue to thrive to the present times. Kenya and Iran are both strategically located and enjoy diverse markets. This creates immense potential for cooperation when it comes to complementing each other's requirements in imports and export arenas.
Now, let's start with you here in the studio, Ambassador Joshua Getimu. Now, can you briefly elaborate to us on the current level of ties between Kenya and Iran?
Thank you, Mubarak. And what I can see is that the two countries, Kenya and Iran, have enjoyed warm and cordial relations within the framework of the Kenya-Iran Joint Commission for Cooperation, JCC, of 2014. And further, The two countries have concluded several agreements and a memorandum of understanding. Mm-hmm. Some of them include, for example, the official development assistance, ODA, credit line facility, and agricultural cooperation. Mm-hmm. Though we have done this, there is more we can do to review the signed agreements and MOUs between the two countries, as many of them remain pending, some have lapsed, and we hope that come June this year, we will be holding the 7th Kenya-Iran Joint Commission for Cooperation in Nairobi, in Kenya, we will be hosting.
Yeah.
That will enrich our bilateral relationship further.
Now, to you, Ambassador Barmaki, can you also briefly elaborate now on the historical aspect of ties between Kenya and Iran?
Yeah, Mubarak, you may know very well that the Iranian travel to this part of the world, I mean East Africa, especially through Mombasa almost four centuries ago, when they appeared to be here along with Omanis, to help the local people of Mombasa to get rid of the oppression of the Portuguese who were here for some decades. Therefore, it was almost 1662 that the Iranian visited this part of the world and helped the local people in overcoming the operations from the big powers at that time. And the second, in fact, migration from the Iranian was in 1820, which again the Baluchi from Iran migrated here, and they helped a lot in developing the coastal area of Kenya.
Thank you very much for that insight. Now, Ambassador Joshua Getimu, what is the importance of the economic and trade ties between the two countries, and where are we moving to right now?
Thank you, Barak. I think as we have heard from my colleague in Kenya, trade relations between the two countries started a long time ago.
Yeah.
With the Iranians, or other type, or Persians, yeah. Oman Arabs, coming to our coastal towns,
yeah.
For business. Mm-hmm. So it's something that has been going on mm-hmm. for a long time. And as years passed on,
yeah.
we have continued with the same trade between the two countries.
Yeah.
And the most of the commodities traded in, for example, from our country,
yeah.
you find that we are tea ranks among the most important one.
Yeah.
Then coffee, and of late I think there is special liking for coffee
yeah.
in Iran amongst the youth, and we are noting that, and also horticultural products to this country. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think it is good to emphasize that though it has been minimal
yeah.
For some years because of sanctions
yeah.
on Iran, which we hope they will come to an end quite soon.
Yeah.
We are still determined to continue with the trade between the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
And from here, I can tell you we have yeah. been getting a lot of petroleum products from Iran.
Yeah.
And I can also say that we have many Iranian business people in Kenya,
okay.
with doing big mm-hmm. business. So mm-hmm. we are connected economically with Iran.
Now, back to you, Ambassador Barmaki. Now, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, what are some of the milestones which have been achieved in the Kenya-Iran ties?
If I want to refer to the milestones in the relations, I can refer to the visit of the high levels at the presidential level between two countries that helped a lot in expanding the relations, not only at the presidential level, but also at the ministerial and the vice president level. This is one part which is mostly political, but I can refer to one of the activities of our embassy here in Nairobi that refers to 1 year back, which is establishing and putting up the Iran House of Innovation and Technology mm-hmm. in Nairobi,
mm-hmm.
which is a very good help to the startups and on those companies who are knowledge-based in,
yeah.
in Kenya and in Iran. That House of Innovation and Technology mm-hmm. is of the Iranian knowledge. They are ready to present technologies to the Kenyan market. This house, which we call Aviation ID, ready to, and at the moment is doing the Kenyan startups in come up with new ideas to commercialize and also finance to send it to the market. These are in political and in economic aspects that I can refer to
mm-hmm.
between two countries. But we are still looking for lots of activities to do, and I hope in coming year I can have good news for you in expanding the relations between two countries that you can consider as milestones in the relations.
Thank you very much for that. Now, Ambassador Getimu, here in Tehran, since you arrived and started your mission, what steps have you taken to, you know, boost the trade and economic ties between Kenya and Iran?
Thank you, Mubarak, for that question. And since my arrival here, almost 1 year ago now, I think in April 13th, I will be 1 year in Tehran.
Oh, wonderful.
And since my arrival here, there have been delegations and delegations from Nairobi of business people. Thanks to my colleague in Nairobi for the support. They have been coming here to look for business opportunities. And I can tell you, during this period, we have had two very important meetings, one in Nairobi, two in Nairobi, for example, last year.
Yeah.
And another one recently in Naivasha, whereby we had a virtual meeting with the people, business people from Iran, some attending the meeting.
Yeah.
And really, Kenyans are anxious. They are ready to go to explore what they can get from here and what they can bring to this part of the world.
Oh, so we look forward to a great future
in
terms of trade.
We look forward to a great interaction as far as business and other activities are concerned.
Now, Ambassador Barmaki, away from business and economic issues, now, what are some of the humanitarian projects and development projects Iran is implementing in Kenya?
If I go back to the records, I can tell you that most of the these developmental and humanitarian assistance to Kenya was belonging before 2015. That according to the records, there were several projects in different parts of the country which amounted to more than $5 million that we financed different projects for different parts, especially the remote areas on different issues like on water, sanitations, on building the schools, and some other matters that were very necessary for that part of the country.
Now, we'll take a short break, viewers, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on the Kenya-Iran ties. Stay with us.
Listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. We have a special program today on the diplomatic ties between Kenya and Iran, which are marking 50 years since their inception. Now, in the studio here, we have Ambassador Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran, and also joining us by a video link from Kenya is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Now, Ambassador Getimu, as you mentioned earlier, it's almost 1 year since you arrived in Iran. Can you tell us how did you find the country and what has been your experience over the last few months here?
Thank you, Barak. And I will be very honest in this one. Apart from what I was read in history a long time ago about the Persian Gulf, you know, the conquerors and so forth.
Yeah.
Before I came here, the information about Iran is out there normally is not the correct one.
Yeah.
So I remember some people would ask us, and my family and my spouse when we were coming.
Yeah.
You people aren't too afraid of that place.
Uh-huh.
Because people think that Iran, especially Tehran, is very insecure.
Yeah.
Because of the propaganda.
The propaganda, yeah. Western media, yes. Propaganda, yeah.
But when we arrived here and looked around,
mm-hmm.
The streets and everything, to me, it looked like any other street in Europe.
Oh, great.
Those old streets, you know, with the cabro, tiles and so forth.
Yeah.
And very civilized people.
Yeah.
People looking, who look like, in fact, Western people from the Western world.
Yeah.
So, my earlier
perception. Yeah.
Changed. And I've come to find out that the Iranians are very good with people.
Yeah.
Very kind.
Yeah.
And they are working.
Oh.
And they are working.
Know that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in our country, because we are also hard working, maybe we borrow some few traits from these parts of the world.
Yeah.
So it's a country to be in, and with their long history, because they have a long history.
Yeah.
There is a lot we can learn from this country in matters of technology, for example.
Yeah.
And new methods, even, you know, we are an agricultural state country. We can learn a lot about agriculture from here.
Yeah.
And as I said about business and so forth, it's really a country that I really intend to build up the relations for the betterment of the people of the two countries.
Thank you. Now, Ambassador Barmaki, as you noted earlier, the historical ties between Kenya and Iran, or actually Iran and the whole of East Africa, have been there for hundreds of years. Now, what is being done to sustain these people-to-people relations between the two nations?
If I look at the activities of the embassy we have done in different areas, with especially in last 1 year, I can tell you that the coordination between two embassies, I mean the Kenyan embassy in Tehran and the Iranian embassy, they had very good relations that rarely can find in the previous relations between two embassies.
Yeah.
And we were very successful in supporting each other. As His Excellency Gatimu referred to, it was for the first time in our relation that in last 1 year, we had 11 delegations exchanged between two countries.
Ambassador Barmaki, our last question to you. Now, recently, there was a United Nations Environment Assembly held in Nairobi, and which voted to end plastic pollution. Can you tell us about the assembly and Iran's participation in this important global summit?
Yeah, thank you, Mubarak. Let me give some introduction on what I do here beside ambassadorial level to Kenya and bilateral. I am also the permanent representative of Iran to United Nations office in Nairobi.
Yeah.
Maybe the audience doesn't know that we have two specialized agencies of the United Nations here, which called United Nations Environment Program and United Nations Human Settlement.
Yeah.
These two are... The headquarters are in Nairobi, and the only headquarters of the United Nations in a developing country. And this is why Kenya is also very important, Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
In that area, this year we had the United Nations Environment Assembly, the fifth session here, which held every 2 years. And one of the important resolutions which has been adopted was on plastic pollution. And Iran was the co-sponsor, along with the other countries, mm-hmm. on this resolution. We succeeded to adopt this resolution in UNIA. And it is going to be to put up an international negotiating committee in 2022 to start preparing a text as a new multilateral environmental agreement on plastic pollution, the whole life of plastic production, from designing to disposal. And it is very important, and although it is very difficult, but we hope that by 2024 we are in a situation to conclude and to adopt the text as a new MEA. And Iran also has been elected from the regional group, Asia regional group, as the vice president to next session of UNIA. And that can help a lot in conducting the negotiation on plastic pollution resolution, which is going to be in next 2 years. Therefore, Iran can play a good role in that, because we have the same position as the vice president for next 2 years in the Bureau of UNIA 6, United Nations Environment Assembly 6.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Jafar Barmaki, for your time. It's been really great having you. And we hope to have more such conversations in future on the ties between these two great nations.
Can I add something, Mubarak, if you have time?
Yeah.
As I mentioned, I am in Mombasa now. I'm here to open the Baluchi Museum, one of the embassy activity in the 50th anniversary of the diplomatic relations between two countries.
Yeah.
In this day afternoon, we are going to open Baluchi Museum, which has been put up in very close collaboration with the Baluchi community in Mombasa and the Iranian embassy in Nairobi. And I hope that I can send you some short video clips from the opening, so you can add to your program.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Your Excellency. Yeah, Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, before we wind up, now, where do you see the Iran-Kenya ties in the next 4 years before the end of your mission?
To be frank, Mubarak, I expect to see more interaction between the political leadership at the top, the business people, between the two countries, and ordinary Kenyans. Those are my expectations.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency, Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, for your time and for accepting our invitation.
Thank you very much, Mubarak.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is very important, very pertinent, very significant. And that question is regarding the permissibility of praying for disbelievers. You know, a lot of people in this world who are Muslims, they live in non-Muslim countries. Or they might live in countries which are predominantly Muslim, but in which there is a significant a portion of the population is non-Muslim. A lot of people are converts to Islam. They have non-Muslim relatives. And, you know, so these people often, you know, they have friends who are Muslims. They have relatives who are Muslims. You know, they love these people, you know, and they want to pray for them just like as they pray for their Muslim relatives or Muslim friends. So sometimes they ask, is it permissible for us to pray for Muslims? Because a lot of times, you know, this question comes up because in certain verses of the Holy Quran, it seems to be that God is almost saying that this is not permissible. For example, in one verse of the Holy Quran, we read that God says, the prophet and the people who are believers are not supposed to ask forgiveness for the polytheists, even if they are their closest relatives. This verse seems to say that, no, this is not permissible, you can't do that. Right. So what's the deal? Can we pray for them or not? If we examine the continuation of this verse, we find the answer to this. In continuation, God says, he adds a clause to this prohibition. He says, after it becomes clear to them that they, meaning those polytheists, are the inhabitants of heaven, are the inhabitants of hell. Meaning after it becomes, they become sure that these people are the inhabitants of hell, it's impermissible for a Muslim to pray for them. The converse of this obviously is that no, if we're not sure about it, we can actually pray for them, we can actually ask forgiveness for them, we can ask God to guide them to the straight path. You know, this is something that's actually reinforced by some other verses of the Holy Quran, this permissibility. For example, we read in the Holy Quran the following regarding the conduct of the Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, who is the father of monotheism and the father of the Abrahamic faiths. You know, one of his uncle, whose name was Azar, right? He was a polytheist and he was a very staunch polytheist. He was very opposed to Ibrahim, Hazrat Ibrahim, and he spoke very threateningly with him. For example, in the Holy Quran we read that, O Abraham, are you inclining away from my God, from my God? If you do not finish what you're doing, I will stone you, and I will exile you from myself. Right? So this is a very staunch polytheist. He's not even a very lenient polytheist, right? But let's look at what Abraham said to him in response to this. Abraham said, "Peace be upon you. I will soon ask forgiveness for you from my Lord." Right? So Hazrat Ibrahim, he prayed for his uncle, Azar, right, even though he was a staunch polytheist. And in continuation, God Almighty clarifies this even more, right, reinforcing what we talked about earlier. God says, after it became clear for Abraham that he, meaning his uncle, Azar, was an enemy of God, he sought refuge from him, in God. I mean, he no longer prayed for him. Right? So this automatically reinforces what we talked about earlier, that it is permissible to pray for non-Muslims as long as we're not sure that they are the inhabitants of hell and that there's no chance for their guidance any longer. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the possibility and permissibility of praying for non-Muslims according to the verses of the Holy Quran. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
American families. Adi is 19 years old. She was born in a village in Ethiopia. At the age of 11, after spending some time in an orphanage, she was adopted by a couple from Ohio. Her biological mother hoped to give her a better future. Instead, the story of Adi became the same odyssey as that of hundreds of children adopted by American families and then, after a few months or years, abandoned and transferred to other families. An exchange of children that takes place absolutely privately, in the shadows, outside the control of authorities. A black market of adoptions.
Cases started to surface in the news a few years ago. It's a practice that's gone on for a long time, but it's become a lot more serious in the last 10 or 15 years because of the way the internet has been used to transfer kids, really in some cases to total strangers. Probably the most disturbing trend and the thing that we're the most concerned about right now is that the internet has become a place where potentially predatory people hold themselves out as families looking to help children. And so you'll see cases where children are transferred by a family no longer willing or able to care for them to a complete stranger without any kind of vetting, without any kind of background check. And oftentimes the child is just put on a plane or put on a bus or dropped off in a parking lot to someone that the family met on the internet but they have no personal real-world relationship with.
To adopt a child in America, all you need is a few clicks on the internet. In the meanders of the web, one can find anything. Facebook pages, blogs, specialized websites, people who want to get rid of adopted children, or people who want to find one. And they find one through photos, publicity ads for little human beings.
Sean is 10 years old. He was adopted 4 years ago in Africa. We are looking for a new family because of his difficulty in bonding with his adopted parents. Jillian's adoption is not going well. She cannot overcome refusal and hostility towards her adoptive mother. Jacob needs a new adoption and a new family where he can learn to accept his siblings.
Thank you. with an all-American hypocrisy. They call them second chance adoption, a second opportunity. If the first adoption doesn't